Why? The way you smell is my son's doing, not your own. I'm well aware of that. They rode past a stable and a shuttered inn with a wheat sheaf painted on its sign. Reek heard music coming through its windows. I knew the first Reek. He stank, though not for want of washing. I have never known a cleaner creature, truth be told. He bathed thrice a day and wore flowers in his hair as if he were a maiden. Once, when my second wife was still alive, he was caught stealing scent from her bedchamber. I had him whipped for that, 12 lashes. Even his blood smelled wrong. The next year, he tried it again. This time, he drank the perfume and almost died of it. It made no matter. The smell was something he was born with. A curse, the small folk said. The guards had made him stink so that men would know his soul was rotting. My old maester said it was a sign of sickness, yet the boy was otherwise as strong as a young bull. No one could stand to be near him, so he slept with the pigs. Until the day that Ramsay's mother appeared at my gates to demand that I provide a servant for my bastard, who was growing up wild and unruly. I gave her Reek. It was meant to be amusing, but he and Ramsay became inseparable. I do wonder, though, was it Ramsay who corrupted Reek, or Reek Ramsay? His lordship glanced at the new Reek with eyes as pale and strange as 2 white moons. What was he whispering whilst he unchained you?
He said to tell you nothing.
The words caught in his throat, and he began to cough and choke. Breathe deep. I know what he said. You're to spy on me and keep his secrets. Bolton chuckled. As if he had secrets. Sir Alan, Luton, Skinner, and the rest. Where does he think they came from? Can he truly believe they are his men?
His men,
Reek echoed. Some comment seemed to be expected of him, but he did not know what to say. Has my bastard ever told you how I got him? That he did know, to his relief.
Yes, my lord. You met his mother whilst out riding, and were smitten by her beauty.
Smitten? Bolton laughed. Did he use that word? Why, the boy has a singer's soul. Though if you believe that song, you may well be dimmer than the first Reek. Even the riding part is wrong. I was hunting a fox along the Weeping Water when I chanced upon a mill and saw a young woman washing clothes in the stream. The old miller had gotten himself a new young wife, a girl not half his age. She was a tall, willowy creature, very healthy-looking, long legs and small firm breasts, like 2 ripe plums. Pretty in a common sort of way. The moment that I set eyes on her, I wanted her. Such was my due. The maesters will tell you that King Jaehaerys abolished the lord's right to the first knight, to appease his shrewish queen. But where the old gods rule, old customs linger. The Umbers keep the first knight too, deny it as they may. A certain of the mountain clans as well. And on Skagos, well, only heart trees ever see half of what they do on Skagos. This miller's marriage had been performed without my leave or knowledge. The man had cheated me. So I had him hanged and claimed my rights beneath the tree where he was swaying. If truth be told, the wench was hardly worth the rope. The fox escaped as well, and on our way back to the Dreadfort, my favourite courser came up lame, so all in all, it was a dismal day. A year later, this same wench had the impudence to turn up at the Dreadfort with a squalling, red-faced monster that she claimed was my own get. I should have had the mother whipped and thrown her child down a well, but the babe did have my eyes. She told me that when her dead husband's brother saw those eyes, he beat her bloody and drove her from the mill. That annoyed me.
so I gave her the mill and had the brother's tongue cut out, to make certain that he did not go running to Winterfell with tales that might disturb Lord Rickard. Each year I sent the woman some piglets and chickens and a bag of stars, on the understanding that she was never to tell the boy who had fathered him. A peaceful land, a quiet people, that has always been my rule.
A fine rule, my lord.
The woman disobeyed me, though. You see what Ramsay is? She made him. Her and Reek, always whispering in his ear about his rights. He should have been content to grind corn. Does he truly think that he can ever rule the North?
He fights for you, Reek blurted out. He's strong.
Bulls are strong. Bears. I've seen my bastard fight. He's not entirely to blame. Reek was his tutor. The first Reek, and Reek was never trained at arms. Ramsay is ferocious, I will grant you, but he swings that sword like a butcher hacking meat.
He's not afraid of anyone, my lord.
He should be. Fear is what keeps a man alive in this world of treachery and deceit. Even here in Barrington, the crows are circling, waiting to feast upon our flesh. The Serwins and the Tallhearts are not to be relied on. My fat friend, Lord Wyman, plots betrayal. And Horsbane, the Umbers may seem simple, but they are not without a certain low cunning. Ramsay should fear them all, as I do. Next time you see him, tell him that.
Tell him? Tell him to be afraid?
Reek felt ill at the very thought of it.
My lord, if I did that, he'd...
I know, Lord Bolton sighed. His blood is bad. He needs to be leeched. The leeches suck away the bad blood, all the rage and pain. No man can think so full of anger. Ramsay, though, his tainted blood would poison even leeches, I fear.
He is your only son?
For the moment. I had another once, Domerick, a quiet boy, but most accomplished. He served 4 years as Lady Dustin's page, and 3 in the Vale as a squire to Lord Redfort. He played the high harp, read histories, and rode like a wind. Horses. The boy was mad for horses, Lady Dustin will tell you. Not even Lord Rickard's daughter could outrace him. And that one was half a horse herself. Redfort said he showed great promise in the lists. A great jouster must be a great horseman first.
Yes, my lord, Domerick, I have heard his name.
Ramsay killed him. A sickness of the bowels, Maester Euthor says, but I say poison. In the Vale, Domerick had enjoyed the company of Redfort's sons. He wanted a brother by his side, so he rode up the Weeping Water to seek my bastard out. I forbade it. But Domerick was a man grown, and thought that he knew better than his father. Now his bones lie beneath the Dreadfort, with the bones of his brothers who died still in the cradle, and I am left with Ramsay. Tell me, my lord, if the kinslayer is accursed, what is a father to do when one son slays another? The question frightened him. Once he had heard Skinner say that the bastard had killed his true-born brother, but he had never dared to believe it.
He could be wrong. Brothers die sometimes. It does not mean that they were killed. My brothers died, and I never killed them. My lord has a new wife to give him sons.
And won't my bastard love that? Lady Walder is a Frey, and she has a fertile feel to her. I have become oddly fond of my fat little wife. The two before her never made a sound in bed, but this one squeals and shudders. I find it quite endearing. If she pops out sons the way she pops in tarts, the Dreadfort will soon be overrun with Boltons. Ramsay will kill them all, of course. That's for the best. I will not live long enough to see new sons to manhood,
and boy lords are the bane of any house. Walder will grieve to see them die, though.
Reek's throat was dry. He could hear the wind rattling the bare branches of the elms that lined the street.
My lord, I...
Milord, remember?
Milord, if I might ask, why did you want me? I'm no use to anyone. I'm not even a man. I'm broken and... the smell...
A bath and a change of clothes will make you smell sweeter.
A bath?
Reek felt a clenching in his guts.
I would sooner not, my lord. Please. I have wounds, I... And these clothes, Lord Ramsay gave them to me. He said that I was never to take them off, save at his command.
You are wearing rags, Lord Bolton said, quite patiently. Filthy things, torn and stained and stinking of blood and urine. And thin. You must be cold. We'll put you in lamb's wool, soft and warm, perhaps a fur-lined cloak. Would you like that?
No.
He could not let them take the clothes Lord Ramsay gave him. He could not let them see him. Would you prefer to dress in silk and velvet? There was a time when you were fond of such, I do recall.
No,
he insisted shrilly.
No, I only want these clothes, Reek's clothes. I'm Reek, it rhymes with peak.
His heart was beating like a drum, and his voice rose to a frightened squeak.
I don't want a bath, please, my lord. Don't take my clothes.
Will you let us wash them, at least?
No, no, my lord, please.
He clutched his tunic to his chest with both hands and hunched down in the saddle, half afraid that Roose Bolton might command his guardsmen to tear the clothes off him right there in the street. As you wish. Bolton's pale eyes looked empty in the moonlight, as if there were no one behind them at all. I mean you no harm, you know. I owe you much and more.
You do? Some part of him was screaming. This is a trap. He's playing with you. The son is just the shadow of the father.
Lord Ramsay played with his hopes all the time.
What? What do you owe me, my lord?
The North. The Starks were done and doomed the night that you took Winterfell. He waved a pale hand, dismissive. All this is only squabbling over spoils. The short journey reached its end at the wooden walls of Barrow Hall. Banners flew from its square towers, flapping in the wind. The flayed man of the Dreadfort, the battle-axe of Serwyn, tall hearts pines, the merman of Manderley, old Lord Locke's cross-keys, the umber giant and the stony hand of flint, the hornwood moose, for the Starts, chevronny, russet and gold, for Slate, a grey field within a double treasure white. Four horse-heads proclaimed the four Risewells of the Rills, one grey, one black, one gold, one brown. The jape was that the Risewells could not even agree upon the colour of their arms. Above them streamed the stag and lion of the boy who sat upon the iron throne 1,000 leagues away. Reek listened to the vanes turning on the old windmill as they rode beneath the gatehouse into a grassy courtyard where stable boys ran out to take their horses. This way, if you please. Lord Bolton led him toward the keep, where the banners were those of the late Lord Dustin and his widowed wife. His showed a spike crown above cross long axes. Hers courted those same arms, with Roderick Risewell's golden horse head. As he climbed a wide flight of wooden steps to the hall, Reek's legs began to shake. He had to stop to steady them, staring up at the grassy slopes of the great barrow. Some claimed it was the grave of the first king who had led the first men to Westeros. Others argued that it must be some king of the giants who was buried there, to account for its size. A few had even been known to say it was no barrow, just a hill. But if so, it was a lonely hill, for most of the barrowlands were flat and windswept.
Inside the hall, a woman stood beside the hearth, warming thin hands above the embers of a dying fire. She was clad all in black, from head to heel, and wore no gold nor gems, but she was highborn, that was plain to see. Though there were wrinkles at the corners of her mouth, and more around her eyes, she still stood tall, unbent, and handsome. Her hair was brown and grey in equal parts, though she wore it tied behind her head in a widow's knot.
"Who is this?"
she said.
"Where is the boy? Did your bastard refuse to give him up? Is this old man his—" "Oh, God! Be good! What is that smell? Has this creature soiled himself?"
"He has been with Ramsay. Lady Barbary, allow me to present the rightful lord of the Iron Islands, Theon of House Greyjoy."
"No," he thought, "no, don't say that name. Ramsay will hear you. He'll know, he'll hurt me."
Her mouth pursed.
"He's not what I expected."
"He is what we have."
"What did your bastard do to him?"
"Remove some skin, I would imagine. A few small parts, nothing too essential."
"Is he mad?"
"He may be. Does it matter?" Reek could hear no more.
"Please, my lord, my lady, there's been some mistake."
He fell to his knees, trembling like a leaf in a winter storm, tears streaming down his ravaged cheeks.
"Oh, I'm not him. I'm not the turncloak. He died at Winterfell. My name is Reek."
He had to remember his name.
"It rhymes with freak."
Sansa. "The longer you keep him waiting, the worse it will go for you," Sandor Clegane warned her. Sansa tried to hurry, but her fingers fumbled at buttons and knots. The Hound was always rough-tongued, but something in the way he had looked at her filled her with dread. Had Joffrey found out about her meetings with Ser Dontos?
"Please, no,"
she thought as she brushed out her hair. Ser Dontos was her only hope.
"I have to look pretty. Joff likes me to look pretty. He's always liked me in this gown, this colour."
She smoothed the cloth down. The fabric was tight across her chest. When she emerged, Sansa walked on the Hound's left, away from the burn side of his face. "Tell me what I've done."
"Not you, your kingly brother."
"Rob's a traitor." Sansa knew the words by rote. "I had no part in whatever he did."
"Gods be good, don't let it be the Kingslayer."
If Rob had harmed Jaime Lannister, it would mean her life. She thought of Sir Ilyen, and those terrible pale eyes staring pitilessly out of that gaunt, pockmarked face. The Hound snorted.
"Ha! I trained you well, little bird."
He conducted her to the lower bailey, where a crowd had gathered around the archery butts. Men moved aside to let them through. She could hear Lord Giles coughing. Loitering stable hands eyed her insolently, but Sir Horace Redwine averted his gaze as she passed, and his brother Hubba pretended not to see her. A yellow cat was dying on the ground, mewling piteously. A crossbow quarrel through its ribs. Sansa stepped around it, feeling ill. Ser Dontos approached on his broomstick horse. Since he'd been too drunk to mount his destrier, the Tawny, the king had decreed that henceforth he must always go horsed.
"Be brave,"
he whispered, squeezing her arm. Joffrey stood in the centre of the throng, winding an ornate crossbow. Sir Boris and Sir Meryn were with him. The sight of them was enough to tie her insides in knots.
"Your Grace."
She fell to her knees.
"Kneeling won't save you now,"
the king said.
"Stand up. You are here to answer for your brother's latest treasons."
"Your Grace, whatever my traitor brother has done, I had no part. You know that. I beg you, please,
get her up."
The Hound pulled her to her feet, not ungently.
"Sir Lancel,"
Joff said,
"tell her of this outrage." Sansa had always thought Lancel Lannister comely and well-spoken, but there was neither pity nor kindness in the look he gave her. "Using some vile sorcery, your brother fell upon Sir Stafford Lannister with an army of wargs, not 3 days' ride from Lannisport. Thousands of good men were butchered as they slept, without the chance to lift sword. After the slaughter, the Northmen feasted on the flesh of the slain." Horror coiled cold hands around Sansa's throat. "You have nothing to say?" asked Joffrey.
"Your Grace, the poor child is shocked witless," murmured Sir Dontus.
"Silence, fool!" Joffrey lifted his crossbow and pointed it at her face. "You Starks are as unnatural as those wolves of yours. I've not forgotten how your monster savaged me."
"That was Arya's wolf," she said. "Lady never hurt you, but you killed her anyway."
"No, your father did," Joff said. "But I killed your father. I wish I'd done it myself. I killed a man last night who was bigger than your father. They came to the gates, shouting my name and calling for bread, like I was some baker. But I taught them better. I shot the loudest of them, right through the throat."
"And he died?" With the ugly head of the quarrel staring her in the face, it was hard to think what else to say.
"Of course he died. He had my quarrel in his throat. There was a woman throwing rocks. I got her as well, but only in the arm." Frowning, he lowered the crossbow. "I'd shoot you too, but if I do, Mother says they'd kill my Uncle Jamie. Instead, you'll just be punished. And we'll send word to your brother about what will happen to you if he doesn't yield. Dog, hit her!"
"Let me beat her," Sir Dontus shoved forward, tin armour clattering. He was armed with a morning star whose head was a melon. "My Florian." She could have kissed him, blotchy skin and broken veins and all. He trotted his broomstick around her, shouting, "Traitor! Traitor!" and whacking her over the head with a melon. Sansa covered herself with her hands, staggering every time the fruit pounded her, a hair sticky by the second blow. People were laughing. The melon flew to pieces. "Laugh, Joffrey," she prayed, as the juice ran down her face and the front of her blue silk gown. "Laugh and be satisfied." Joffrey did not so much as snigger.
"Boris! Meryn!"
Sir Meryn Trant seized Dantus by the arm and flung him brusquely away. The red-faced fool went sprawling, broomstick, melon and all. Sir Boris seized Sansa.
"Leave her face," Joffrey commanded. "I like her pretty."
Boris slammed a fist into Sansa's belly, driving the air out of her. When she doubled over, the knight grabbed her hair and drew his sword, and for one hideous instant she was certain he meant to open her throat. As he lay the flat of the blade across her thighs, she thought her legs might break from the force of the blow. Sansa screamed, tears welled in her eyes. "It will be over soon." She soon lost count of the blows.
"Enough!"
she heard the hound rasp.
"No, it isn't," the king replied. "Boris, make her naked."
Boris shoved a meaty hand on the front of Sansa's bodice and gave a hard yank. The silk came tearing away, baring her to the waist. Sansa covered her breast with her hands. She could hear sniggers, far off and cruel.
"Beat her bloody," Joffrey said. "We'll see how her brother fancies. What is the meaning of this?"
The imp's voice cracked like a whip, and suddenly Sansa was free. She stumbled to her knees, arms crossed over her chest, her breath ragged.
"Is this your notion of chivalry, Sir Boris?"
Tyrion Lannister demanded angrily. His pet sellsword stood with him, and one of his wildlings, the one with the burned eye.
"What sort of knight beats helpless maids?" "The sort who serves his king, imp."
Sir Boris raised his sword, and Sir Meryn stepped up beside him,
his blade scraping clean of its scabbard. "Careful with those," warned the dwarf sellsword. "You don't want to get blood all over those pretty white cloaks." "Someone give the girl something to cover herself with," the imp said. Sandor Clegane unfastened his cloak and tossed it at her. Sansa clutched it against her chest, fists bunched hard in the white wool. The coarse weave was scratchy against her skin, but no velvet ever felt so fine. "This girl's to be your queen," the imp told Joffrey. "Have you no regard for her honor? I'm punishing her. For what crime? She did not fight her brother's battle. She has the blood of a wolf, and you have the wits of a goose. You can't talk to me that way. The king can do as he likes." "Aerys Targaryen did as he liked. Has your mother ever told you what happened to him?" Sir Boros Blunt hurrumped. "No man threatens his grace in the presence of the king's guard." Tyrion Lannister raised an eyebrow. "I'm not threatening the king, sir. I'm educating my nephew, Bronn Timmit. The next time Sir Boros opens his mouth, kill him." The dwarf smiled. "Now that was a threat, sir. See the difference?" Sir Boros turned a dark shade of red.
"The queen will hear of this."
"No doubt she will. And why wait? Joffrey, shall we send for your mother?" The king flushed. "Nothing to say, your grace," his uncle went on. "Good. Learn to use your ears more and your mouth less, or your reign will be shorter than I am. Wanton brutality is no way to win your people's love, or your queen's."
"Fear is better than love, mother says." Joffrey pointed at Sansa. "She fears me."
The imp sighed. "Yes, I see. A pity Stannis and Renly aren't 12-year-old girls as well. Bronn, Timmit, bring her." Sansa moved as if in a dream. She thought the imp's men would take her back to her bedchamber in Maegor's Holdfast, but instead they conducted her to the Tower of the Hand. She had not set foot inside that place since the day her father fell from grace, and it made her feel faint to climb those steps again. Some serving girls took charge of her, mouthing meaningless comforts to stop her shaking. One stripped off the ruins of her gown and small clothes, and another bathed her and washed the sticky juice from her face and her hair. As they scrubbed her down with soap and sluiced warm water over her head, all she could see were the faces from the bailey. "Knights are sworn to defend the weak, protect women, and fight for the right. But none of them did a thing."
Only Sedontus had tried to help, and he was no longer a knight, no more than the imp was, nor the hound. The hound hated knights.
"I hate them too," Sansa thought. "They are no true knights, not one of them."
After she was clean, plump, ginger-headed Maester Frenkin came to see her. He bid her lie face down on the mattress while he spread a salve across the angry red welts that covered the backs of her legs. Afterwards, he mixed her a draught of dream wine, with some honey so it might go down easier.
"Sleep a bit, child. When you awake, all this will seem a bad dream."
"No, it won't, you stupid man," Sansa thought. But she drank the dream wine anyway, and slept. It was dark when she woke again, not quite knowing where she was. The room, both strange and strangely familiar. As she rose, a stab of pain went through her legs and brought it all back. Tears filled her eyes. Someone had laid out a robe for her beside the bed. Sansa slipped it on and opened the door. Outside stood a hard-faced woman with leathery brown skin. Three necklaces looped about her scrawny neck. One was gold, and one was silver, and one was made of human ears.
"Where does she think she's going?" the woman asked, leaning on a tall spear.
"The Godswood. She had to find Sir Dantas, beg him to take her home now, before it was too late.
"The half-man says you're not to leave," the woman says. "Pray here. The gods will hear."
Meekly, Sansa dropped her eyes and retreated back inside. She realized suddenly why this place seemed so familiar. They've put me in Arya's old bedchamber, from when Father was the Hand of the King. All her things are gone, and the furnishings have been moved around, but it's the same. A short time later, a serving girl brought a platter of cheese and bread and olives, with a flagon of cold water. "Take it away," Sansa commanded, but the girl left the food on a table. She was thirsty, she realized. Every step sent knives through her thighs, but she made herself cross the room. She drank two cups of water and was nibbling on an olive when the knock came. Anxiously, she turned toward the door, smoothed down the folds of her robe. "Yes?" The door opened, and Tyrion Lannister stepped inside.
"My lady, I trust I'm not disturbing you."
"Am I your prisoner?"
"My guest."
He was wearing his chain of office, a necklace of linked golden hands.
I thought we might talk."
"As my lord commands." Sansa found it hard not to stare. His face was so ugly, it held a queer fascination for her. "The food and garments are to your satisfaction?" he asked. "If there is anything else you need, you have only to ask." "You are most kind. And this morning, it was very good of you to help me." "You have a right to know why Joffrey was so wroth. 6 nights gone, your brother fell upon my uncle Stafford and camped with his host at a village called Oxcross, not 3 days' ride from Casterly Rock. Your northerners won a crushing victory. We received word only this morning."
"Rob will kill you all," she thought, exulting. "It's terrible, my lord. My brother is a vile traitor."
The dwarf smiled wanly.
"Well, he's no fawn. He's made that clear enough."
"Sir Lancel said Rob led an army of wargs." The imp gave a disdainful bark of laughter.
"Sir Lancel's a wineskin warrior who wouldn't know a warg from a wart. Your brother had his dire wolf with him, but I suspect that's as far as it went. The Northman crept into my uncle's camp and cut his horse lines, and Lord Stark sent his wolf among them. Even war-trained destriers went mad. Knights were trampled to death in their pavilions, and the rabble woke in terror and fled, casting aside their weapons to run the faster. Sir Stafford was slain as he chased after a horse. Lord Rickard Carstark drove a lance through his chest. Sir Rupert Brax is also dead, along with Sir Lyman Vickery, Lord Crecall, and Lord Jast. 500 more have been taken captive, including Jast's sons and my nephew, Martin Lannister. Those who survived are spreading wild tales and swearing that the old gods of the North march with your brother."
"Then there was no sorcery?" Lannister snorted.
"Sorcery is the sauce fools spoon over failure to hide the flavour of their own incompetence. My mutton-headed uncle had not even troubled to post centuries, it would seem. His host was raw, apprentice boys, miners, field-hands, fisher-folk, the sweepings of Lannisport. The only mystery is how your brother reached him. Our forces still hold the stronghold at the Golden Tooth, and they swear he did not pass."
The dwarf gave an irritated shrug.
"Well, Rob Stark is my father's bane. Joffrey is mine. Tell me, what do you feel for my kingly nephew?"
"I love him with all my heart," Sansa said at once.
"Truly?"
He did not sound convinced. "Even now?"
"My love for his grace is greater than it ever has been."
The imp laughed aloud.
"Well, someone has taught you to lie well. You may be grateful for that one day, child.
You are a child still, are you not? Or have you flowered?
Sansa blushed. It was a rude question, but the shame of being stripped before half the castle made it seem like nothing.
No, my lord.
Oh, that's all to the good. If it gives you any solace, I do not intend that you ever wed Joffrey. No marriage will reconcile Stark and Lannister after all that has happened, I fear. More's the pity. The match was one of King Robert's better notions, if Joffrey hadn't mucked it up. She knew she ought to say something, but the words caught in her throat.
You grow very quiet, Tyrion Lannister observed. Is this what you want? An end to your betrothal?
Sansa did not know what to say.
Is it a trick? Will he punish me if I tell the truth?
She stared at the dwarf's brutal, bulging brow, the hard black eye and the shrewd green one, the crooked teeth and wiry beard.
I only want to be loyal.
Loyal, the dwarf mused, and far from any Lannisters. I can scarce blame you for that. When I was your age, I wanted the same thing.
He smiled.
They tell me you visit the God's Wood every day. What you pray for, Sansa?
I pray for Rob's victory and Joff's death, and for home, for Winterfell.
I pray for an end to the fighting.
We'll have that soon enough. There will be another battle between your brother Rob and my lord father, and that will settle the issue.
Rob will beat him, Sansa thought. He beat your uncle and your brother Jaime. He'll beat your father, too.
It was as if her face were an open book, so easily did the dwarf read her hopes.
Do not take Oxcross too much to heart, my lady, he told her, not unkindly. A battle is not a war, and my lord father is assuredly not my uncle Stafford. The next time you visit the Godswood, pray that your brother has the wisdom to bend the knee. Once the North returns to the king's peace, I mean to send you home.
He hopped down off the window seat and said,
You may sleep here tonight. I'll give you some of my own men as a guard. Some stone crows, perhaps.
No, Sansa blurted out aghast. If she was locked in the Tower of the Hand, guarded by the dwarf's men, how would Ser Dontos ever spirit her away to freedom?
Would you prefer black ears? I'll give you Chella, if a woman would make you more at ease.
Please, no, my lord. The wildlings frighten me.
He grinned.
Me as well. But more to the point, they frighten Joffrey and that nest of sly vipers and lick-spittle dogs he calls a king's guard. With Chella or Timid by your side, no one would dare offer you arm.
I would sooner return to my own bed.
A lie came to her suddenly, but it seemed so right that she blurted it out at once.
This tower was where my father's men were slain. Their ghosts would give me terrible dreams, and I would see their blood wherever I looked.
Tyrion Lannister studied her face.
I am no stranger to nightmares, Sansa. Perhaps you are wiser than I knew. Permit me at least to escort you safely back to your own chambers.
Tyrion. Nothing remained beyond the King's Gate but mud and ashes and bits of burned bone. Yet already there were people living in the shadow of the city walls, and others selling fish from barrows and barrels. Tyrion felt their eyes on him as he rode past, chilly eyes, angry and unsympathetic. No one dared speak to him, or try to bar his way, not with Brunn beside him in oiled black mail.
If I were alone, though, they would pull me down and smash my face in with a cobblestone, as they did for Preston Greenfield.
They come back quicker than the rats, he complained. We burn them out once. You'd think they'd take that as a lesson. Give me a few dozen gold cloaks, and I'll kill them all,
said Bronn. "Once they're dead, they don't come back."
"No, but others come in their places. Leave them be. But if they start throwing up hovels against the wall again, pull them down at once. The war's not done yet, no matter what these fools may think." He spied the mud gate up ahead. "I have seen enough for now. We'll return on the morrow with the guild masters to go over their plans," he sighed. "Well, I burned most of this. I suppose it's only just that I rebuild it." That task was to have been his uncle's. But solid, steady, tireless Sir Kevin Lannister had not been himself since the Raven had come from Riverrun with word of his son's murder. Willem's twin, Martin, had been taken captive by Robb Stark as well, and their elder brother, Lancel, was still abed, beset by an ulcerating wound that would not heal. With one son dead and two more in mortal danger, Sir Kevin was consumed by grief and fear. Lord Tywin had always relied on his brother, but now he had no choice but to turn again to his dwarf son. The cost of rebuilding was going to be ruinous, but there was no help for that. King's Landing was the realm's principal harbour, rivaled only by Old Town. The river had to be reopened, and the sooner the better. And where am I going to find the bloody coin? It was almost enough to make him miss Littlefinger, who had sailed north a fortnight past. While he beds Lysa Arran and rules the Vale beside her, I get to clean up the mess he left behind him. Though at least his father was giving him significant work to do. "He won't name me heir to Casterly Rock, but he'll make use of me wherever he can," Tyrion thought, as a captain of gold cloaks waved them through the mud gate. The three whores still dominated the market square inside the gate, but they stood idle now, and the boulders and barrels of pitch had all been trundled away. There were children climbing the towering wooden structures, swarming up like monkeys in rough spun, to perch on the throwing arms and hoot at each other. "Remind me to Tessa Adam to put some gold cloaks here," Tyrion told Bronn as they rode between two of the trebuchets. "Some fool boy is likely to fall off and break his back." There was a shout from above, and a clod of manure exploded on the ground a foot in front of them. Tyrion's mare reared and almost threw him. "On second thoughts," he said when he had the horse in hand, "let the poxy brats spatter on the cobbles like overripe melons." He was in a black mood, and not just because a few street urchins wanted to pelt him with dung. His marriage was a daily agony. Sansa Stark remained a maiden, and half the castle seemed to know it. When they had saddled up this morning, he heard two of the stable boys sniggering behind his back. He could almost imagine that the horses were sniggering as well. He'd risked his skin to avoid the bedding ritual, hoping to preserve the privacy of his bedchamber, but that hope had been dashed quick enough. Either Sansa had been stupid enough to confide in one of her bedmaids, every one of whom was a spy for Cersei, or Varys and his little birds were to blame. What difference did it make? They were laughing at him all the same. The only person in the Red Keep who didn't seem to find his marriage a source of amusement was his lady wife. Sansa's misery was deepening every day. Tyrion would gladly have broken through her courtesy to give her what solace he might, but it was no good. No words would ever make him fair in her eyes. Or any less a Lannister. This was the wife they had given him for all the rest of his life, and she hated him. And their nights together in the great bed were another source of torment. He could no longer bear to sleep naked, as had been his custom. His wife was too well trained ever to say an unkind word, but the revulsion in her eyes, whenever she looked on his body, was more than he could bear. Tyrion had commanded Sansa to wear a sleeping shift as well. "I want her," he realized. "I want Winterfell, yes, but I want her as well, child or woman or whatever she is. I want to comfort her. I want to hear her laugh. I want her to come to me willingly, to bring me her joys and her sorrows and her lust."
his mouth twisted in a bitter smile.
"Yes, and I want to be tall as Jamie and as strong as Sir Gregor the Mountain, too, for all the bloody good it does."
Unbidden, his thoughts went to Shay. Tyrion had not wanted her to hear the news from any lips but his own, so he had commanded Varys to bring her to him the night before his wedding. They met again in the eunuch's chambers, and when Shay began to undo the laces of his jerkin, he caught her by the wrist and pushed it away.
"Wait," he said, "there is something you must hear. On the morrow I am to be wed to Sansa Stark, I know."
He was speechless for an instant. Even Sansa did not know, not then.
"How could you know? Did Varys tell you?" "Some page was telling Sir Tallard about it when I took Lollies to the Sept. He had it from this serving girl who'd heard Sir Kevin talking to your father."
She wriggled free of his grasp and pulled her dress up over her head. As ever, she was naked underneath.
"I don't care. She's only a little girl. You'll give her a big belly and come back to me."
Some part of him had hoped for less indifference.
"Had hoped," he jeered bitterly. "But now you know better, dwarf. Shay is all the love you're ever like to have."
Muddy Way was crowded, but soldiers and townfolk alike made way for the imp and his escort. Hollow-eyed children swarmed underfoot, some looking up in silent appeal while others begged noisily. Tyrion pulled a big fistful of coppers from his purse and tossed them in the air, and the children went running for them, shoving and shouting. The lucky ones might be able to buy a heel of stale bread tonight. He had never seen market so crowded, and for all the food the Tyrells were bringing in, prices remained shockingly high. 6 coppers for a melon, 1 silver stag for a bushel of corn, 1 dragon for a side of beef, or 6 skinny piglets. Yet there seemed no lack of buyers. Gaunt men and haggard women crowded around every wagon and stall, whilst others, even more ragged, looked on sullenly from the mouths of alleys.
"This way," Bronn said, as they reached the foot of the hook, "if you still mean to—"
"I do." The riverfront had made a convenient excuse, but Tyrion had another purpose today. It was not a task he relished, but it must be done. They turned away from Aegon's high hill into the maze of smaller streets that clustered around the foot of Visenya's. Bronn led the way. Once or twice, Tyrion glanced back over his shoulder to see if they were being followed, but there was nothing to be seen except the usual rabble. A carter beating his horse, an old woman throwing night soil from her window, 2 little boys fighting with sticks, 3 gold cloaks escorting a captive. They all looked innocent, but any one of them could be his undoing. Varys had informers everywhere. They turned at a corner, and again at the next, and rode slowly through a crowd of women at a well. Bronn led him along a curving wind through an alley under a broken archway. They cut through the rubble where a house had burned and walked their horses up a shallow flight of stone steps. The buildings were close and poor. Bronn halted at the mouth of a crooked alley too narrow for 2 to ride abreast.
"There's 2 jags and then a dead end. The sink is in the cellar of the last building."
Tyrion swung down off his horse. "See that no one enters or leaves till I return. This won't take long." His hand went into his cloak to make certain the gold was still there in the hidden pocket. 30 dragons. A bloody fortune for a man like him. He waddled up the alley quickly, anxious to be done with this. The wine sink was a dismal place, dark and damp, walls pale with nitre, the ceiling so low that Bronn would have to duck to keep from hitting his head on the beams. Tyrion Lannister had no such problem. At this hour the front room was empty, but for a dead-eyed woman who sat on a stool behind a rough plank bar. She handed him a cup of sour wine and said, "In the back." The back room was even darker. A flickering candle burned on a low table beside a flagon of wine. The man behind it scarce looked in danger, a short man, though all men were tall to Tyrion, with thinning brown hair, pink cheeks, and a little pot pushing at the bone buttons of his doeskin jerkin. In his soft hands he held a 12-stringed woodharp, more deadly than a longsword. Tyrion sat across from him. "Simon Silvertongue?" The man inclined his head. He was bald on top.
"My lord and,"
he said, "you mistake me. My father is the king's hand. I am no longer even a finger, I fear."
"You shall rise again, I am sure, a man like you. My sweet lady, she tells me, you are newly wed. Would that you had sent for me earlier. I should have been honoured to sing at your feast."
"The last thing my wife needs is more songs," said Tyrion. "As for she, we both know she is no lady, and I would thank you never to speak her name aloud."
"As the hand commands,"
Simon said. The last time Tyrion had seen the man, a sharp word had been enough to set him sweating, but it seemed the singer had found some courage somewhere, most like in that flagon. Or perhaps Tyrion himself was to blame for this new boldness. "I threatened him, but nothing ever came of the threat, so now he believes me toothless." He sighed. "I am told you are a very gifted singer."
"You're most kind to say so, my lord."
Tyrion gave him a smile. "I think it is time you brought your music to the free cities. They are great lovers of song in Braavos and Pentos and Lys, and generous with those who please them." He took a sip of wine. It was foul stuff, but strong. "A tour of all 9 cities would be best. You wouldn't want to deny anyone the joy of hearing you sing. A year in each would suffice." He reached inside his cloak to where the gold was hidden.
"With a port closed, you will need to go to Duskendale to take ship, but my man Brun will find a horse for you, and I would be honoured if you would let me pay your passage." "But, my lord," the man objected, "you've never heard me sing. Pray, listen a moment."
His fingers moved deftly over the strings of the woodharp, and soft music filled the cellar. Simon began to sing.
"He rode through the streets of the city, down from his hill on high, o'er the wynds and the steps and the cobbles, he rode to a woman's sigh. For she was his secret treasure, she was his shame and his bliss, and a chain and a keep are nothing compared to a woman's kiss." "There's more,"
the man said as he broke off.
"Oh, a good deal more. The refrain is especially nice, I think. For hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm."
"Enough." Tyrion slid his fingers from his cloak empty. "That's not a song I would care to hear again. Ever."
"No."
Simon Silvertongue put his harp aside and took a sip of wine.
A pity. Still, each man has his song, as my old master used to say when he was teaching me to play. Others might like my tune better. The Queen, perhaps, or your Lord Father."
Tyrion rubbed the scar over his nose and said, "My father has no time for singers, and my sister is not as generous as one might think. A wise man could earn more from silence than from song." He could not put it much plainer than that. Simon seemed to take his meaning quick enough.
"You will find my price modest, my lord."
"That's good to know." This would not be a matter of 30 golden dragons, Tyrion feared.
"Tell me, at King Joffrey's wedding feast," the man said, "there is to be a tournament of singers."
"And jugglers and jesters and dancing bears."
"Only one dancing bear, my lord,"
said Simon, who had plainly attended Cersei's arrangements with far more interest than Tyrion had.
"But 7 singers, Galleon of Kai, Bethany Fairfingers, Aemon Costain, Alric of Ison, Hamish the Harper, Collio Canis,
and all in the Old Town will compete for a gilded lute with silver strings. Yet unaccountably, no invitation has been forthcoming for one who is master of them all. Let me guess, Simon Silvertongue.
Simon smiled modestly.
I'm prepared to prove the truth of my boast before king and court. Hamish is old and oft forgets what he's singing. And Collio, with that absurd Tyroshi accent. If you understand one word in three, count yourself fortunate.
My sweet sister has arranged the feast. Even if I could secure you this invitation, it might look queer. Seven kingdoms, seven vows, seven challenges, 77 dishes, but 8 singers? What would the High Septon think?
You did not strike me as a pious man, my lord.
Piety is not the point. Certain forms must be observed. Simon took a sip of wine.
Still, a singer's life is not without peril. We ply our trade in alehouses and wine sinks before unruly drunkards. If one of your sister's 7 should suffer some mishap, I hope you might consider me to fill his place.
He smiled slyly, inordinately pleased with himself. 6 singers would be as unfortunate as 8, to be sure. I will inquire after the health of Cersei's 7. If any of them should be indisposed, my man Bronn will find you.
Very good, my lord.
Simon might have left it at that, but flushed with triumph, he added,
I shall sing the night of King Joffrey's wedding. Should it happen that I am called to court, why, I will want to offer the king my very best compositions, songs I have sung 1,000 times that are certain to please. If I should find myself singing in some dreary wine sink, though, well, that would be an apt occasion to try my new song. For the hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm.
That will not be necessary, said Tyrion. You have my word as a Lannister. Bronn will call upon you soon.
Very good, my lord.
The balding, kettle-bellied singer took up his wood harp again. Bronn was waiting with the horses at the mouth of the alley. He helped Tyrion into his saddle.
When do I take the man to Duskendale?
You don't, Tyrion turned his horse. Give him 3 days, then inform him that Hamish the harper has broken his arm. Tell him that his clothes will never serve for court, so he must be fitted for new garb at once. He'll come with you quick enough. He grimaced. You may want his tongue. I understand it's made of silver. The rest of him should never be found. Bronn grinned.
There's a pot shop I know in Flea Bottom makes a savoury bowl of brown. All kinds of meat in it, I hear.
Make certain I never eat there. Tyrion spurred to a trot. He wanted a bath, and the hotter the better. Even that modest pleasure was denied him, however. No sooner had he returned to his chambers than Podrick Payne informed him that he had been summoned to the Tower of the Hand.
His lordship wants to see you, the Hand, Lord Tywin.
I recall who the Hand is, Pod, Tyrion said. I lost my nose, not my wits. Bronn laughed.
Don't bite the boy's head off now.
Why not? He never uses it. Tyrion wondered what he'd done now. Or more like, what I have failed to do. A summons from Lord Tywin always had teeth. His father never sent for him just to share a meal or a cup of wine, that was for certain. As he entered his Lord Father Solar, a few moments later, he heard a voice saying, Cherry wood for the scabbards, bound in red leather and ornamented with a row of lion's head studs in pure gold, perhaps with garnets for the eyes.
Rubies? Lord Tywin said, "A garnet, lack the fire."
Tyrion cleared his throat. My lord, you sent for me? His father glanced up.
I did. Come, have a look at this.
A bundle of oilcloth lay on the table between them, and Lord Tywin had a longsword in his hand.
"A wedding gift for Joffrey," he told Tyrion.
The light shimmering through the diamond-shaped panes of glass made the blade shimmer black and red as Lord Tywin